Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. A staff writer at The New Yorker for a quarter of a century, Susan Orlean hit international bestsellerdom with The Orchid Thief. And then came the hit film adaptation starring Meryl Streep, who portrays Orlean. Her other books include The Bullfighter, Checks or Makeup, My Encounters with Extraordinary People, My Kind of Place, travel stories from a woman who's been everywhere, and Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. Her latest, The Library Book, is an investigation into a 1986 fire at the Los Angeles Central Library that consumed 400,000 volumes and damaged another 700,000. In addition to shedding light on what happened, Orlean's eighth book is a thrilling celebration for an institution that she's cherished since she was a child. As a part of the Creative Life Conversation series at the University at Albany before a live audience at the Recital Hall in the Performing Arts Center, it is a great pleasure to welcome Susan Orlean to this week's book show.
Thank you.
Oh my goodness. It is so good to see you.
And I'm thrilled to be here.
What was it about the story when you found out about the fire that happened in Los Angeles in the late 80s that caught your attention?
Before I heard about the fire, I had been just idly thinking about libraries and looking at them as places that were so familiar to me, but the fact is I really knew nothing about how they operated or what the life would be like in a library day after day. And as a journalist, it was sort of tickling at the back of my mind that there was a good story to be written about just the life of a library. But I just felt that there wasn't a narrative drive that would make that work as a book. I then was taking my son to the library right after we'd moved to Los Angeles. When we were driving to the library, and this was our first visit to the branch library near our house, it occurred to me that it was about the same distance from our house as my childhood branch had been. So I began thinking, oh, I used to do that with my mom all the time. When we walked in the door of the library, I was absolutely struck dumb. It's not that the library looked that much like my childhood library, but something about the feel of it, the smell of it, the sound of it, the experience of going there with my child, it just catapulted me backward in time in my memories to those trips with my mother. So I began thinking, why? You know, I went to a lot of places with my mother, and I don't walk, say, into a grocery store and find myself having an epiphany.
Right.
I mean, this was so particular to the library. I began thinking there is something about libraries that we connect with emotionally in a way that's distinct, that's unique. What is it? You know, you could look at a library in a very simplistic way. It's just a place full of books that you can borrow. But that's not our experience of it. It's a very emotional thing for so many of us. So that coupled with what was already an existing curiosity on my part of thinking, well, how do libraries actually function? And what's it like day to day in a library? Then was coupled with this emotional recognition, this feeling that there was something there that I wanted to understand about why libraries would mean so much.
At this point, from my understanding, you were losing your mom as well.
This became a really unexpected urgency to the project. My mother was fine when I first told her I was going to write a book about the library, and very soon after, she was diagnosed with dementia. So part of my sense of urgency in trying to capture these memories had to do with observing her losing her memories. And that was coupled very, almost perfectly, with my appreciation for what libraries do, which is they remember for all of us. They remember knowledge and narrative and fantasy and information and fables, history, that libraries are our tool of remembering. So it became a kind of Russian doll that my mother was quickly losing her ability to remember our trips to the library, and I wanted to write them down to preserve them in a way that was the only way I could see that could survive the paltry ability of a human memory. Mm. I mean, libraries have this remarkable ability, which is to essentially be immortal.
Quickly, you make the point, as you do throughout the book, that obviously libraries are so associated with books, and yet there's so much more to them.
That was the great shock to me, and a pleasant shock, but the remarkable surprise of what libraries contain. Not only photographs, which I think we've come to understand libraries have, and movies, and video, and audio recordings, but then there are all of these other things, maps and atlases, and the LA Public Library has a set of life-size puppets that belong to a puppet theater that was very popular in LA in the 50s, and matchbook collections, and just remarkable collections that they acquire over the course of their existence. It's not just that people come and dump off whatever they've got sitting in their attic. I mean, this is curated, and they're collected deliberately and thoughtfully.
How much of it do you think is the fact that it's a city library? It was Los Angeles, and it was a city that was growing at this time. But my goodness, the characters that you got to play with as far as the librarians who started men, then very quickly women, and then a mix. And it's fascinating, and they were all characters.
Well, I've decided that there is a Venn diagram somewhere, and there's a circle of eccentric people, and then there's a circle of librarians, and then there's a circle of Los Angeles. And the overlap is considerable. And as a writer, of course, I was delighted, but it was all a surprise to me. And each and every one of the head librarians could have been a book unto himself or herself. I mean, they each had an amazing backstory. Their tenure was remarkable. And they were, in many cases, a little extreme in the, you know, spectrum of human behavior.
I think I know the answer to this question, but who is the most fascinating to you? And I ask that only because it seems like you spend a lot of time on this particular individual.
Yes, well, Charles Lummis was kind of irresistible and a remarkable figure in California history. Extraordinary man.
Can I just ask, because I lost track. I tried to keep track and then I lost track. How many times was that guy married?
Oh, my God. I mean, it depends if you consider it had to be a marriage in the eyes of the law, or he was married.
Well, he had two at once,
four or five times, but he kept a diary of his lovers, and a very conservative estimate was 55 extramarital affairs.
Wow.
And he had
librarians.
And yeah. You said it all right there. Yeah. Well, he's an amazing character, and he would have easily been a book entirely unto himself. What's interesting is there are people who know about Charles Lummis because he was very significant in the history of California, but a lot of people didn't know he had ever served as the head of the library. There have been a number of biographies written of him, and in many cases they just mention his stay at the library very briefly, and in fact, I would say every single day of his tenure at the library was dramatic in one way or another. I mean, whether it was he was taking his branding iron and running around branding books with the skull and crossbones to warn people not to read them, or whether he was deploying the Human Encyclopedia to corner innocent people at the library and
this
demand...
This is a real person, the human encyclopedia.
Yeah, Lummis was remarkable. And he also, as much as his eccentricities were remarkable, he actually made enormous change to the library and modernized it in certain ways that remain in place even now. So he's not a buffoon. He's not... I mean, he was certainly an eccentric and somebody whose life, I would say, wouldn't be a role model for a lot of people. Mm. But he also was so passionate about books and so passionate about making the library a great place that a lot of the things he did were really smart and really meaningful in the life of the library. At the time he took over, libraries were still seen as really aimed to the elite. I mean, women didn't have full use of the library. Children weren't permitted. And it was really thought of as a place for people who were already educated to go. He looked at it very differently, and he saw it as an equalizer, as a place where people could come and become educated. And that was a kind of radical position to take when librarianship up until that point had been very much a sort of gentlemanly profession, and you were serving other gentlemanly people. You weren't doing what Charles Lummis did, which was going to factories, talking to the foreman at the factory, and saying, please encourage your workers to use the library. And he did that.
Let us talk just about the librarians for one more moment. Obviously, a great number of incredible women who were at the helm of the Los Angeles Public Library, Central Branch. That's an amazing part of the story, too.
There were women running the library in L.A. before women were actually allowed to use the library. Just to give you an idea, how early on L.A. had women in a management role at a time when that was not the case. Librarianship was a very male profession. The women who ran the library were beginning with the very first head of the library, this young woman, Mary Foy, who was 18 when she was the head of the library. Her dad would walk her home from work. She was the city librarian of L.A. and had to be walked home from work because she was that young. But there were amazing women, strong, independent, modern-thinking women like Mary Jones, like Althea Warren, who really made the library what it is. And were doing it at a time when that was not as common as we would now expect it to be, that there would be women running the library. And they were amazing.
At the time of the fire, you don't say this in the book, but it was my impression, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the guy who was running the library at the time of the fire, the head librarian, was kind of a jerk.
He was
that as a yes.
He was a complicated person.
Yeah.
And my experience with him was almost comic. It was so irritating. He was a narcissistic, argumentative, brilliant, annoying, arrogant man. And he came in at a time when the Central Library building was in pretty well-acknowledged disrepair. And there had been a debate going on since 1960 about whether they should tear it down and build a new library that was bigger and modern and so forth. And he came in expecting that that's what he was going to do, that they were going to tear down this building and either sell the land and build elsewhere or build a new modern building on this land. It was a grudging admission on his part, finally, when the city at long last decided to preserve the building. So he accepted it as an inevitability, but it was not what he wanted to do.
Susan Orlean is our guest. We're talking about the library book published by Simon and Schuster. A big part of the story is about the fire and the inevitable question of how did that happen? How did the fire start? And if it was arson, who started it? We read a lot in the book about a man by the name of Harry Peake, who is the main suspect in the fire. And he himself is a fascinating guy who is, I would think, would be fascinating and yet very frustrating to write about.
Absolutely. In fact, I would say this book was filled with fascinating, frustrating individuals. Harry was somebody who everybody loved and everybody said he drove them crazy. I didn't talk to a single person, including his own family, who didn't say, you know, Harry, gotta love him, but boy, I could have killed him. It was across the board. And there was a point at which I began thinking, boy, Harry, love him, but I sure could kill him. He was an inveterate liar. He fibbed about what color the sky was. He fibbed about everything. He fibbed so much that it was the one reliable thing about him was that you couldn't rely on anything he said. He was such a fabulist. If he came home late one day and his roommates would say, where were you? He'd say, well, I was having lunch with Cher. Or, you know, oh, I was having a coffee with Burt Reynolds. And they would think, no, you weren't. Everything was a story. Everything was a yarn. Everything was a fabulous story. And it meant that people grew weary of him after a while, as much as they might love him and find him charming, and he sounded like a genuinely charming guy, and somebody who meant no harm to anyone. He was not a mean or evil guy, but he drove everyone nuts.
You learn in reading the book very early that he passed not really that long after the fire. Was that at all for you a challenge? Was that something that, upon reflection, you thought, well, boy, it'd be great if he were around?
Well, when I first heard that he had passed away, my first thought was, I can't do the book. But when I grappled a little with the meaning of him not being here, and the fact is also that his having passed away became very significant in how the whole story of the crime got resolved. I realized that I could write the story through the people who knew him and through the depositions and through his lawyer and through all the people that I came to interview who knew him well and who painted a picture of him that I think was pretty thorough.
Was it also a challenge in knowing that you didn't have the answer to the mystery?
That was a big challenge. There was a point where I felt that I needed to have an answer or the book would be incomplete or the book would be a failure. And then I guess I'm a great believer in making a silk purse out of a sow's ear. And I thought, you know, I don't have the answer, but no one has the answer. It's not as if I simply failed to do the one interview that was going to tell me the answer. The fact is that it remains unresolved for everybody, for all of us. I decided to write the book in a sense as a choose-your-own-adventure story, that you could read it and say, I see the path to where he was the arsonist. Or you could read it and see it as, no, he wasn't. And the resolution is one of a couple of different options. It was someone else, or maybe it was not an arson at all, or, you know, one of these other outcomes. And I'm happy to say that I don't think readers have found that a hindrance in enjoying the book. I think they have opinions, and they want my opinion on what really happened. But maybe it's more true to life that we don't have a concrete answer to something like this.
In your writing of the book, you mentioned earlier how libraries take things and they keep them forever, and they protect them. And yet, your writing is very in the moment. You will say, recently I spoke to, the other day I met with Dale. I assume that is conscious.
It's very conscious. It's partly a device that I think creates intimacy with the reader, because at the moment that I'm writing it, it was the other day.
Right.
I'm trying to have you feel as if you are traveling this road with me and learning what I'm learning alongside me. And so that immediacy feels natural. It feels correct. At the same time, between the time I write the book and when it's published, it's no longer the other day, but in that moment, it is the other day. And I think as a reader, it makes you feel really close to the writer to have that sense of immediacy.
We always say on radio that here is where the listener is.
And that's actually a perfect analog, because for the reader, when they're reading the book, that's the eternal now, is the moment when they're reading it. And so for the purposes of experiencing the book, it was the other day. It doesn't matter if it's 6 months or a year or 10 years ago.
When you are telling the story, the construction of the book, how did that take place in the sense, as you say, there are these narrative paths? So I believe I've heard you talk about the 5x7 cards that you have all over that kind of bring your diagram as to how this is going to work.
Right. Well, I had no idea how I was going to structure the book after I'd done the reporting. And I was genuinely puzzled as to how I was going to write a book in which there were many different timelines. There was the timeline of the history of the library. There was 1986 when the fire occurred. There was the present day. There were so many different
right.
timelines, and they were equally important, which is what made it challenging. So I put all of my notes on these 5x7 index cards and began spreading them out and looking at them and trying to figure out if they began to take a shape. And I realized that each section had to have coherence, but that I didn't need the book to have a timeline that began on page 1 and continued chronologically to page 300, that I could move the reader from one section of time to another, much the way my experience of reporting the book went that way. I mean, one day I would be writing, reporting about the fire. The next day I would spend at the circulation desk at the library. And then the day after that, I'd be researching Bertram Goodhue and his first airplane flight that inspired him as an architect. So I wrote the book in a way reflecting how I came upon the information, but also with the idea that the reader would entertain the idea that they were browsing among a number of different little books, and that they would read about the fire, and then they would read about, you know, 1900 in Los Angeles, and then they would read about the present day in the shipping department, and then they'd go back to the fire. And that each of those sections had an internal logic, but that they could be placed alongside each other the way books in a library would be.
You write, all the things that are wrong in the world seem conquered by a library's simple, unbroken promise. Here I am, please tell me your story. Here is my story, please listen. That's a hell of a way to end a book.
And I realized that it was what made this book mean so much to me. That as a writer, I'm telling a story and I want people to listen. As a reader, I pull books off a shelf because I want to hear their story. And that we've been doing that as a civilization since the day we gathered together.
Susan Orlean is the author of the library book. It is published by Simon & Schuster. What a great pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks so much.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.